Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I'm not keeping you from anything important, am I?
No.
Just thought I'd come over and say hello to you. I'll try anything once.
What's your name? I said mine.
Holly.
Well, listen, Holly. You, I don't know. Want to take a walk with me?
What for?
Oh, I got some stuff to say. Guess I'm kind of lucky that way. Most people don't have anything on their minds, do they?
I don't think my daddy would like me to be seen with anyone who does top five lists for a living.
It is a vulgar racket, but what does your daddy know about top five lists, Josh? Especially one as good as this week's Terrence Malick Scenes.
That first meeting between Kit and Holly in Badlands, that's a pretty good one.
It definitely is. Plus our review of Malick's latest, To the Wonder, with Ben Affleck and Rachel McAdams. Or so I'm told Rachel McAdams is in the movie.
She is in the movie, Adam. We're going to have that and more.
Let's do this, Josh. It's Magic Hour.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM4. You're listening to Film Spotting. We'll wrap up our Max Ophuls marathon with 1955's Lola Montez, and we'll whisper our top five Terrence Malick scenes a bit later in the show.
But first, Adam and I are going to do our review of To the Wonder entirely in voiceover.
How will that be any different than usual?
Good point. Let's tackle Terrence Malick's latest anyway.
My sweet love. My hope.
You're everything to me. Speak with me.
Love is not only a feeling. Love is a duty. To commit yourself is to run the risk of failure, the risk of betrayal. But the man who makes a mistake can repent. You fear your love has died. It perhaps is waiting to be transformed into something higher.
The term Malick-esque, or my preference, Josh, is Malickian, has come to have a certain meaning over the years. Like with any great auteur, there are expectations the audience walks into the theater with based on the elusive filmmaker's body of work. Among them, explorations of man versus nature, explorations of faith, a predilection for voiceover, a camera that is almost constantly in motion, occasionally tilted straight up at the sky to showcase the trees and leaves and sun in all its glory. The Malick shot for me is that tracking shot he does behind a character about waist level, their hand gently gliding over some tall grass or a field of wheat. Every one of these is on display in Malick's latest film, To the Wonder, which is only his sixth feature since his brilliant 1971 debut, Badlands. For those who found his last movie, The Tree of Life, shapeless, maybe too conceptual, To the Wonder is likely to test your patience even further. And that's without any sequences involving the creation of the universe and dinosaurs. The story, as it goes, is about an American man, Ben Affleck, who falls in love with a European woman, Olga Kurylenko, while traveling and brings her back to Oklahoma, where their relationship, like most of the human variety, has its share of agonies and ecstasies. Javier Bardem appears as a local priest, Rachel McAdams, too, as a former flame to Affleck's Neil. Sure, it sounds straightforward enough, but Malick here seems intent on challenging narrative expectations, pushing the limits of how much he can express and have an audience accept with minimal dialogue and virtually no exposition or psychological understanding of character motivations. The abstract, to be sure, has always been Malick's realm, but I'd argue To the Wonder often makes Tree of Life seem downright conventional by comparison. At least all of the non-Sean Penn scenes, anyway. Josh, we both adored that film. The Tree of Life was our number one film of 2011. Does his experimentation here pay off? Is this another truly transcendent work by a truly visionary artist?
Well, you should know I usually go with Malickian, too.
Good.
That's the preferred
term. We can
term.
Agree on that. That
we
may be all we agree on.
Agree on that. Possibly, because I'm going to start out by completely disagreeing with your premise that
really?
This is unconventional.
I wondered if you would.
I think this is his most conventional film since Badlands.
Wow.
In form, it has a lot of this elusiveness. You're right about that. But in terms of narrative, this is very straightforward. It's very personal. It's very small, at least on the surface. It's a relationship drama. Now, Malick being Malick, he uses this, in my mind, as a giant metaphor for another relationship. And we'll get to that. But even that, I feel like, is pretty, if anything, it's heavy-handed. I mean, I got a very good sense of what I thought, at least, Malick was going for mm-hmm. here, when in some of his other films, it's a lot more esoteric. I do think you're right in terms of these characters. It's not portraying a relationship the way we're used to, with dialogue that explains what they're feeling,
mm-hmm.
even scenes that necessarily explain their motivations.
And that's what I'm focusing on, yes.
And that I was okay with that
mm-hmm.
because what I felt throughout this movie, because of the heightened style he uses and the pretty dead-on voiceover dialogue
yes.
he gives us, I felt I was getting the tremors of these characters' hearts. I didn't need to know exactly why they began to fade out of love. I didn't need to have – there is one – argument scene, you could describe it, but we only sense that an argument is going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea what they're arguing about or what prompted it.
Right.
Or, and this is crucial to my enjoyment of this movie, who's at fault? It's not really worried about those sorts of things.
No.
And I found that freeing. I found this lack of conventionality in that sense freeing, while at the same time, it was so clear what Malick was going after to me in trying to use this small human relationship as a metaphor for people pursuing relationship mm-hmm. with God and how people can have that and it fades. And it's not something even a priest. We saw this in The Diary of a Country Priest,
right.
The Bresson film. It's essentially a riff on that Bresson film where not even a priest can be guaranteed that a relationship they feel they have with God will continue throughout their life. When that fades, it's hugely jarring to a person, just as it's jarring to this central couple who are so in love at the beginning and they start to lose each other. Some might say this movie is obvious and heavy-handed, that we didn't even need the character of the priest because it rams that home so mm-hmm. obviously.
Yeah, I don't want to get sidetracked too much by this question I posed in the premise of how straightforward it is or how challenging and unconventional it is, because I'm not sure it's that fruitful, just as a statement of fact, not really as a judgment against the film. That's exactly what I was talking about, though. Things like with this couple, there's a time where Olga Kurylenko, her character's name is Marina, we'll call her that. It's time for her to leave. Her visa is up. We hear that one line that she says to Neil, my visa's up. And we get the sense that things aren't going well with their relationship. The next thing we know, they're at the airport. She's leaving. It's as simple as that.
But did
it's
that not... take you by surprise?
Well, yeah, it did a little bit.
Really?
Just in terms of conventional narrative, you expect a little bit more to set that up. You don't get that here. I'm not saying, again, that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's the type of story it is. Same thing later where we hear one little line about the fact that she wants to come back to the United States. We get no sense at all, really, of whether or not Neil wants her back. In fact, if anything, I get the sense he probably doesn't. The next thing you know, she's back.
Mm-hmm.
She's just there. And they're even having a ceremony at the local courthouse. That all kind of takes you by surprise. So that's what I'm talking about when I refer to it being unconventional. And Malick letting the audience just fill in a lot of blanks. And I would say even more so than we had to do in The Tree of Life. I did not have the same reaction to this film you did. I did not have that same strong personal reaction to it. And it's been a while since I felt this way about a Terrence Malick movie. The last one was The Thin Red Line, which I have to confess I just really need to see again. It's been a long time. But the one word I think of when I watch To the Wonder, and it really encapsulated for me all of Malick's universe and how I think of all of his characters, there's the word yearning. There is a yearning for something bigger than themselves, something beyond themselves, a longing for physical connections, spiritual connections with people and with nature. And that's really fascinating often. But watching To the Wonder, I got the sense that characters who are only defined by their yearning, as I felt these characters were, they're just as one-dimensional as characters who are completely lacking self-awareness and blissfully content to sleepwalk through life. And I did feel that way watching Marina and Neil here. These are characters that seem to me only defined by how they behave. And behave's the key word, not really act. We don't really see them act a whole lot. I'm not talking about the actors, I mean the characters. They just behave in emotional situations, extreme emotional situations. Everything is either childlike playfulness. Half this movie is Affleck and Kirilenko tickling each other and wrestling and generally being goofily romantic, or a combination of fiery anger and disaffected resentment where they're just staring at each other blankly, mystified by the other's inability to love them properly. Let's be honest, Affleck is fine in this movie, Josh, but he spends most of this film doing nothing but looking ruggedly handsome in the latest J. Crew Environmental Survey casual wear. His sweaters and coats are pretty great, even if they're as bland as the look on his face for most of this movie. I guess for me, what kept me from really attaching to these characters and being engaged by this film was that for a movie that seemed to me about the complexity of love, the mysteries of love, the various forms love can take, the actual depictions of that love on screen struck me as incredibly banal.
I think you're asking too much of the film. I don't think it's interested in all of that stuff and trying to depict all that stuff. I think you're right. It's just about the yearning, and it's wanting to hang on to. Once that yearning has been met, they both, when they first meet, you get a sense, because they are a little bit older than a conventional romance, mm-hmm. that they've had experiences and there are allusions to this in their life before. They are yearning for love again. And when they have that, they want to hang on to it. It's pretty simple in those terms. Mm-hmm. Sure, I'll give you that. But I think other emotions do come into play, like responsibility and duty. When Marina comes back, it's not long after Affleck has had a talk about marriage with the McAdams character, who is a high school sweetheart, you get a sense.
And yeah.
After Marina leaves, he picks up with her. They start to get closer. Marriage comes up, and that sort of falls apart. And pretty quickly after that,
She's gone,
and Marina comes back.
Yes.
So there's a sense of duty there in the Affleck character. You mentioned The Thin Red Line, and I think it's interesting because that's a Malick film I respect. Not one of my favorites of his. But I think one characteristic of that movie that's interesting is the way we're watching warfare, despite all the voiceovers, I didn't get a sense that we were watching warfare necessarily from the perspective of all those characters as much as from, let's just say, an angel that has floated down and is observing.
It's an omnipresent sort of camera.
It is.
Yeah.
And Wings of Desire comes to mind, too, in terms of Malick's style, that we don't necessarily get what we have in conventional dramas in terms of the motivations and the reasons and maybe all the intricacies that you were looking for. Mm-hmm. I have that very same sense with To the Wonder, that we're watching this relationship, maybe not an angel, maybe in this case it's someone like Marina's daughter who's about 10 and comes with her and moves in with Affleck. And how kids get a sense, this isn't played up too much. The daughter's
no.
a minor character, but as we're talking about this, it comes to mind, kids will get sort of an outside sense. They can feel those tremors too. They don't know why mom and dad are arguing or why mom and dad don't hug each other as much as they used to, but boy, can they feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And To the Wonder gets those feelings.
It's going bankrupt. No, he claimed he didn't want to have kids while he was in school.
She hadn't changed.
Yeah, it's nice, didn't want to be gambling debts and this ranch that's falling apart.
I caught you on the right day, then.
I do want to talk about Affleck because I was pretty blown away by what he's doing here. And I'm not saying he's giving a Daniel Day-Lewis performance, but he's doing more than
looking
good.
He's not being asked to do that.
No, he's not being asked to do that. It's much more than the catalog poses are a problem. I'll give you that in the entire McAdams sequence. And I think that's a good place to talk about this because there's one reason those don't work as well, and it's because McAdams is not giving the kind of performance that Affleck is and that a Malick film needs.
I agree with
and
you.
And it's one that is completely unaware of the camera. And I got the sense that McAdams was always trying to look around the camera, past the camera, over the camera. she knew it was there.
Mm-hmm.
Affleck, you never get that sense. He is just Bean.
Mm-hmm.
And that works for me. Also, his physical aspect is so crucial to a movie like this that is not going to need dialogue to explain things. Instead, we need a guy who's solid. He's big. He's in opposition to Marina, direct opposition, in a sense that she is light and also in terms of movement.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't move much. And you can make fun of that because it's throughout the film. But at the same time, it's very purposeful in that she is always twirling, to use the phrase Dana Stevens referred to in her unfortunately negative review on Slate.
Yeah.
She is always twirling and Affleck is always still. I loved that opposition between the two of them.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're having a little bit of opposition ourselves about the new film from director Terrence Malick. It's called To the Wonder. I think your use of the word purposeful there, or with a purpose, is key, because that's what I felt was lacking. And when I talk about how I thought the depictions of love in these characters was one-dimensional and banal, it's because I think that Marina's character is largely reduced to the sum of her twirling, just as Ben Affleck is largely reduced to the sum of his standing still and being very stoic. I'm not disagreeing that he's good in the role, especially, you're absolutely right, that's a great observation about Rachel McAdams. I think he is much better than her, and Kirilenko, we can say the same thing. They can exist on camera in a way that is less self-aware and I think much more effective. Again, I just didn't feel like there was enough of a purpose, and I didn't ultimately feel like his character was that interesting. I don't want to spend too much time comparing it to Tree of Life, but when you talk about the visual style, because I think this is an extension of what we saw there, certainly very elliptical, very nonlinear, even more so than some of his films previous. I think The Tree of Life was maybe kind of a little bit of a departure point, and now he, in my opinion, is taking it even a step further. The thing I love about The Tree of Life and how the camera works there is that it's not just an authorial affectation. Sean Penn's character in that movie is playing the young boy as an older man, and he's looking back through this prism of his childhood and reflecting on his past. That's what we're seeing, his reflections on the past. So the camera is like a dream there. It's constantly moving. It's seeking information. I think it's seeking revelation. And here, for me, the camera, the sound design, they don't seek that revelation, or they don't provide any kind of revelation. They only obfuscate. And I think that the characters in some of his previous works, they weren't just the sum of those conditions, their unhappy conditions, that yearning that I felt like here. They were complex and surprising, and sometimes they were tender, and sometimes they were obstinate, and they were just full of a whole gamut of emotions. And I didn't get that kind of depth here with these characters. And I thought I was really locked in, Josh, actually, when Javier Bardem appeared. And then Rachel McAdams appeared, and I realized, or I thought I realized, where Malick was going. Okay, we're going to meet Ben Affleck. We're going to meet Kirilenko's character. But this is going to be an ensemble piece where we're going to see four different views on love and that yearning. And they've all been hurt before, it seems. And they all want something different out of love, I think. We could definitely talk about what McAdams is seeking versus what the priest, Javier Bardem, is seeking. But then, you know, you don't have to read tweets or read articles to get the sense that, yep, sure enough, there had to be a lot left on the cutting room floor. Rachel McAdams, she's in this movie for about 15 minutes, and then she's just gone. And even Javier Bardem, he was so underdeveloped that the scenes that struck me as Malick going for almost a pseudo-documentary style, where that priest is interacting with, I think we can call them non-professionals. I haven't read this, but they struck me as non-professional actors who are struggling with addiction or disease or imprisonment, whatever their affliction might be. Those scenes, to me, actually came off as kind of cheap and kind of cynical.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say cheap or cynical, but as I mentioned at the start, I could envision a very good movie completely without them.
Sure.
I think we get some good Javier Bardem moments. I like the moment with the janitor where they talk about, again, fairly explicit, the janitor holds his hand against the stained glass in Bardem's church and
right.
says, you've got to feel the warmth. That's spiritual. But I did like that moment. We get a few others. But really, this movie, I think you're onto something in that it's a little bit in between. It's almost that Malick wanted to just make a movie about these two, the Affleck and the Kirilenko character, and have them stand in for some sort of universal yearning, which is a good word to use for this film. And it opened up a little bit to include these other characters, the Bardem one to sort of hammer home a metaphor, and McAdams, which doesn't really work at any level. And it would have probably been better off just focusing on those two. It feels a little bit like a trial run for The Tree of Life in some odd ways. I think it is interested in far less than the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a far
right. It's
less
not talking about
film.
The creation of the world.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we're talking about a movie that was it's in one of my top 20 when we did our own Sight and Sound list. So it is not quite fair to compare the two. And I know that's not what you want to do. So I think there's something going on here with To the Wonder in that it's this small film that doesn't feel like much of a movement forward. It certainly feels like a bit of a letdown maybe to some from the Tree of Life, but on its own terms and what it's interested in doing, I appreciated that.
One thing I thought was really fascinating, and we've already talked about nature a little bit here, and the portrayal of it here was something that struck me as a little bit different than previous Terrence Malick films. And I'm sure some people listening who are more familiar with his films or maybe have caught up with them recently will write in and point out that it's not that black and white. I know it's not that black and white, but Malick has always struck me as sort of the Professor X to Werner Herzog's Magneto when it comes to their approach to nature. Herzog is all about the horror of the natural world, the chaos and danger of it all, man's absurd attempts to overcome it. And Malick is all about retreating into nature, escaping the chaos and danger of the modern world. Think about John Smith and Pocahontas in The New World. Think about Kit and Holly in Badlands and their real one moment of real grace in that film, Badlands. Affleck here seems to be some sort of environmental tester. And while these Oklahoma neighborhoods and these ranches mostly are unbelievably beautiful, as shown to us by Malick and his incredibly talented DP, Emmanuel Lubezki, that's what you would expect from them. We also see how ravaged much of the environment is, how poisoned the land is. For the first time, Josh, watching a Malick film, I got the sense that the natural world was as sick as the people inhabiting it. Maybe that's always been Malick's point, more or less, this idea of man overtaking nature and that struggle. But watching this movie, I got the sense that man has won, largely.
I think it's a much more depressing Malick film than we've gotten yet. Mm-hmm. That I would agree with. I think this thread has been in a lot of his movies. You're right, he does hold nature up as an Eden mm-hmm. in just about every one of his films. And then he often tracks the despoiling of that Eden. So in The Thin Red Line, it's warfare. In The New World, it's the discovery of this world by Europeans. Here, we do have that thread. There's more despoiling that the movie charts. I thought that was an interesting aspect of it, too. And it does feel more sickening, especially as juxtaposed with the early images of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting, too. We're getting a little bit away from nature and more into architecture there.
That's it, yeah.
Where we do see these old cathedrals in Europe, this beautiful tidal island they visit. And then we go to Middle America, which Malick does have some affection for. He's not just lampooning it or going after it. It does look beautiful, but it's also very flat. It's very beige. There are power lines.
Mm-hmm.
There are asphalt roofs that are everywhere.
Right.
And he notices that.
And fences and boundaries.
Fences and the yards are fenced in, and
yep.
they spend a lot of time in their backyards mm-hmm. fenced in. So I think you're onto something. And again, this is another point of reflection of how this movie is depressing from Malick's travels throughout his films in terms of that yearning and that spiritual searching. This is the one where he's most explicitly looking for God. Some of his characters are directly, and I feel like the main couple are doing it metaphorically, and he doesn't find them in this film.
Right.
And he found God in other places in almost every one of his earlier pictures.
Well, let me hit you with a spiritual question here, or a religious-focused question then along those lines, because you're right. It's there in The Tree of Life. It's probably there in all of his films, but really explicitly in this film. And I'm wondering, can you really call this a Christian film if it's a film about characters who clearly can't fill the hole inside of them with love, including the priest who's directly searching for and not finding God anywhere? Is this reinforcing, in your mind, Christian values?
Undoubtedly, you could
really
call it a Christian film. I don't think it's reinforcing Christian values, but I don't think that's the good definition of a Christian film. I think it is Christian concerns. Let's say that.
Okay,
and that might
I agree
be,
with that.
And that might be off-putting to some viewers who aren't interested in that or don't have that background. This is what also makes it very personal. One of Malick's most personal films, I feel, is that he's laying that out there in a sense. So I think you can find that interesting. Sure, it's not an affirmation. There will likely be people of faith who see this and are pretty depressed by it, but it's honest, and there are people of faith who have very likely experienced this sort of thing. So
mm-hmm.
it has that sort of honesty that will resonate with people too. Affirming? No, I wouldn't say so at all.
I do think it's curious, and I'm not really going to argue with you about it, but I think it's interesting that you use the word personal with this film because I didn't feel that, and here maybe it is now coming too much off the Tree of Life, and I hate to go down that path anyway because what do we know about his autobiography?
Sure.
Especially of all directors,
right.
him.
Exactly.
And that's a slippery slope anyway. But watching The Tree of Life, even if I knew nothing about Terrence Malick at all, knew that he grew up in Waco, the images and the memories are so vivid and so intense, and there's so much nuanced pain on display that you would watch that film and think, man, that filmmaker had to go through that himself. I agree with you that watching this movie, you get the sense that the filmmaker is exploring some of his own questions about faith, but the film on the whole didn't have that intensity and that vibrancy that I was really hoping for, I guess. I do want to acknowledge, though, some of the shots and the editing, and I know it's simple to say how wonderful the film looks, but there are some moments in particular with Affleck and Kirilenko where they're moving parallel with each other, and they really are moving all the time. The camera is always moving here. And then we get this wonderful match cut where it goes from them moving parallel with each other to an amusement park ride that's
mimicking their
movements. And it's just a perfect visual metaphor for their relationship. And there's a scene later, about three quarters of the way through the movie, where she's running through a grocery store. And then the next thing we know, we get this series of cuts, and then the next cut is her running on their lawn. And it picks up perfectly. Again, it's another match action that just startles you, but it's really graceful at the same time. And then there's a shot near the end of the movie where she's walking down an airport tunnel heading to a plane. And that moment is as much a shot of a character walking into the afterlife, walking into the wonder, if you will, as I've ever seen on film. And the way it's lit and the way it captures that is really interesting. I do want to add as well, Josh, that when you brought up the way Europe is shot here, you see how Europe is shot when the two characters are in love. It's much like those Oklahoma scenes are shot when they're in love and they're out in nature together. Despite the architecture and the focus on that. But what is it like when we go back to her and now she doesn't have her daughter and she's not in love? She doesn't have Neil with her. Those scenes, the camera is much more just sort of tracking her. It's kind of stalking her along. We don't get the same wide shots that we get. We almost get the sense, which doesn't happen much in a Malick film, that it's a very claustrophobic environment. And it perfectly reflects her psychological state of mind, and we understand when she says, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, there are some really great match shots, the one you mentioned in this movie. What I also noticed this time, and Malick's done this for quite a while, but the way he edits within a scene itself, so that we're following a character walking along, and then suddenly we'll cut, and we're still following that character maybe three steps ahead, or five steps ahead, something like that. It's somehow very gentle compared to some of, we've talked about Trance recently, the frenzied editing.
Yeah, gentle, not the right word
there. But it's still a lot of cuts. I almost wonder if there might be as many cuts in a Malick scene as there is in a Danny Boyle scene, but somehow there's some more time in between them, and they're overlapped with the same images so that it feels almost like instead of, you know, chopping vegetables, it's like slicing a warm loaf of bread or something is how Malick does it.
Yeah.
And it's so distinctive, and so many of the moments in this movie use that just wonderfully.
To the Wonder is out now via cable on demand and also iTunes, though I can't say I probably recommend watching it on your computer. Maybe your TV at home, a little bit. Yeah, the computer, I'm not so sure about. It's also playing in select cities around the country. It's out in Chicago this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can also find us on Twitter, @filmspotting, and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Up next, the poll results for your favorite Terrence Malick location. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the winner probably features Gently Blowing Grasses.
Yeah, safe bet.
Then Max Ophuls redefines the greatest show on earth with 1955's Lola Montez. Stay with us.
Dream the day. To the end.
Hey, folks, wanted to jump in for a second for a couple of promotional mentions. First, we do want to give a nod to our music this week from Low, a Duluth, Minnesota-based band. You can hear music from their new album, The Invisible Way. Waiting and So Blue are the tunes we're featuring this week, and they're kicking off a European tour in Birmingham, UK on April 24th. Maybe some listeners there in that area who want to seek them out. We also hope you'll seek out the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, our partner over there with that great podcast where he interviews screenwriters, great guests every week on the show. Just do a search in iTunes for the Q&A, or you can find a direct link in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And we also want to promote MoviePass one more time. This is the great offering that allows you to see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. All you have to do is go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the offer code filmspotting to get $10 off your first month. We're also brought to you once again by our friends at Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for whatever your next creative project is, whether it's a website, a multimedia presentation, or anything else. You can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They source their video clips largely from filmmakers around the world, and they review each one individually for content and quality. They're actually adding 10,000 video clips each week. So anytime you go there, you're going to find something new, and you can search by category, clip, resolution, contributor, and a lot more. And if you're working within a team, you can access your selections anytime just by sharing them with other team members after you've put them in a clip box.
Shutterstock really is a complete offering. They have excellent customer service with dedicated reps and 24-hour support Monday through Friday. They also have flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or video packs. Download clips in HD. You could also save those with standard definition or web formats. And they have a huge image library of photos, vectors, icons, and infographic templates. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM4. That way, new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM4. We thank Shutterstock for their support. We take the chance can no longer bear to miss the dance with you.
Oh, we say we were going to stop. They wanted to see the ruins.
Yeah, but should we wake them up?
No.
You know what, let's do? On our way back to the airport, we can catch him.
Hmm? You know we won't.
Yeah, I'm probably not.
Okay. And how did you two meet?
We met about 18 years ago. We kind of, sort of, fell in love. And a decade later, we ran into each other.
No. You wrote a book, and I read about it and went to look for it.
Oh, that's pretty romantic.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Of course.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's a great movie pairing. Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke as Celine and Jesse in Richard Linklater's upcoming film, Before Midnight, the third film in that triptych with Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. It's out in May. We cannot wait to see it, as we are big fans of those first two movies here on the show. And that made us think about other exciting director-actor reunions that are going to be happening this summer. And we'll get to that poll question here in a minute as we set up our upcoming summer movie preview. But now it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this movie.
It's quite a lovely Jackson Pollock, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What does it say to you?
It restates the negativeness of the universe. The hideous, lonely emptiness of existence, nothingness, the predicament of man forced to live in a barren, godless eternity, like a tiny flame flickering in an immense void with nothing but waste, horror, and degradation, forming a useless, bleak straitjacket in a black, absurd cosmos.
What are you doing Saturday night?
Committing suicide.
What about Friday night?
That was Woody Allen as Allen, Diana Davila as the girl in the museum from 1972's Play It Again, Sam, directed by Herbert Ross and written by Allen.
We heard from Max O'Connell in Muncie, Indiana. He's a Muncie guy. This week's Massacre Theater is Play It Again, Sam, in which noir icon Humphrey Bogart appears to Woody Allen, which ties into your top five neo-noirs to some degree. More to the point, however, it's a tie-in to the painting heist film Trance you discussed, as the massacred scene takes place in an art gallery.
Nice job, Max. Anthony from Boston, Massachusetts said, despite the surprisingly subdued Jude Allen, the dialogue made its author clear. I spotted two connections to Play It Again, Sam: the protagonist's film critic career as an homage to Roger Ebert, and the pivotal role of Bogart, a lead in many non-neo-noirs.
There you go. Indeed, tie-ins abound.
And I was not doing Woody Allen, because
no,
he doesn't do it in the
he
scene.
He doesn't.
And
if
nothing else, I honor the text.
I wanted to note that you did honor the text, maybe for the first time in your career.
What?
Here, Josh. We also heard from Zach Adams in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's hard to get more neo-noir than a ghost of Humphrey Bogart guiding Woody Allen on how to win over the dames. I was probably around 12 or 13 the first time my dad showed me Play It Again, Sam. And from then on, Woody's line, "She bought it," after taking Bogey's advice to impress the girl, was every bit as iconic in my house as "Here's looking at you, kid." It's great to hear this often overlooked and underrated film get some love. I think if Woody had also directed it — he was, of course, the star and wrote the screenplay and play it's adapted from — Play It Again, Sam would be remembered right up there with some of his other masterpieces.
Would you agree with that, Adam, Mr. Woody Allen fan?
Well, I don't think I would put it in the top 10, but he's got 10 pretty great films, so that really isn't saying much. Thanks, Zach, and to all of our commenters this week, and everyone who did recognize Play It Again, Sam. A pretty brimming film spotting hat. Actually, maybe enough people, whether they've seen it or not, Josh, they recognize that Woody Allen sense of humor there in those lines of dialogue. We got more entries than we got last week for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And if you do want to hear Josh's non-Woody Allen Woody Allen and our review of Trance along with our top five neo-noirs with writer Christopher Harris, you can get that at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. We also took that opportunity to pay tribute to the late, great Roger Ebert. Why don't you reach into that hat, go through those entries, and pick out this week's winner, Josh?
The winner is Jessica Greer from Kent, Ohio.
Congratulations, Jessica. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
No, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free. Josh, I think the only hint we can really provide with this scene, and I'm not sure a hint is really needed — this isn't maybe a widely seen, widely adored film, but there are some giveaways in the dialogue, I think, that might make it kind of obvious. The hint would be there is a connection to our discussion of To the Wonder and Terrence Malick.
Yeah, and if I nail this part, it's going to be very obvious. So
yeah, if you do, I can't wait to see what you
I'm
do.
I'm not
with
saying
it.
That's going to happen.
No. Well, you just got to go for it, Josh, and try to bring that truth. So I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action.
All right. And action.
You think it's the process that's at fault.
Who cares what I think? I'm not the president. I'm just a storyteller, man. That's all I am.
Well, I presume, at the very least, you care something about what you sing every night.
How can I answer that if you got the nerve to ask me?
You know, I am convinced about one thing. You either do truly care about nothing at all, or so tremendously much that people think so.
You asked for my time?
And scene. I think you finally got it on
did
that
it?
Third line,
last
Josh.
Word? It took the last word.
I still heard a little bit of the Hitchhiker from Texas Chainsaw Massacre
well,
in there.
He does stick around.
Only you could bring that element. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, April 22nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I met this guy named Ding Dong. He told me the whole earth is going up in flames. Flames will come out of here and there, and they'll just rise up. The mountains are gonna go up in big flames. The water's gonna rise in flames. There's gonna be creatures running every which way. Some of them burnt, half their wings burning. People are gonna be screaming and hollering for help. See? The people that have been good, they're going to go to heaven and escape all that fire.
Shocker! I need shocker!
But if you've been bad, God don't even hear you. He don't even hear you talking.
Well, speaking of Terrence Malick, as we are a lot on this show, that's 1978's Days of Heaven. Linda Manns as Linda in that film. And we were looking ahead to our discussion of To the Wonder and our favorite Terrence Malick scenes this week as we posed to you last week's poll question. We wanted to know not your favorite scene, but what's your favorite Terrence Malick location? We did talk about nature a lot and the way Malick captures nature in his films. And we went through his five films prior to The Wonder and found the locations that really stand out to us and think they're ones you probably most closely associate with Malick and his work, and we gave you these options. The Treehouse in Badlands, The Fields at Magic Hour in Days of Heaven, The Pacific Islands in The Thin Red Line, Pocahontas' Jungle, The Forest in The New World, or finally, The O'Brien's Neighborhood and that yard in particular in The Tree of Life. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, not a lot of love for The New World and Pocahontas' Jungle, only 12%. That's fitting. That's the only Malick film I'm really not too wild about.
And you're so wrong about
it, too. I'm fine to see that.
So wrong.
The Treehouse in Badlands, my choice, received 17%. Right in the middle was The O'Brien's Neighborhood from The Tree of Life with 18%. And then The Pacific Islands of The Thin Red Line received 22% of the vote, which means The Fields at Magic Hour in Days of Heaven won with 31%.
Not surprising to me, just because when everyone talks about Malick, that's really one of the first images you think of are those fields at the Magic Hour. Really, the bulk of the film shot at Magic Hour, and it really is a beautiful sight. The Treehouse in Badlands, I'm surprised, maybe didn't finish a little better. But The Thin Red Line, you see that in second place with 22%. We've already lamented how that's a movie for us that we didn't completely connect to. And certainly based on feedback over the years on this show, I say it all the time, but talk about movies I need to revisit. A lot of Film Spotting listeners just love that film, and there clearly must be something I didn't get when I saw it back in the theater whenever it came out.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind revisiting that either, though I probably have to give The New World a second look first, because I know there's a core group that just adores that one as
I'm
well. Are you
it.
Among them?
I am part of it, and it's going to come up in our top five Malick scenes, and rewatching a good 30 minutes of that film last night in preparation for this list, I was just struck again by how really, really phenomenal that movie is. Let's get to this week's poll question, and we are looking ahead to our upcoming summer movie preview. It is that time, Iron Man 3 opening May 3rd, and of course, we're not going to go too populist here. Heaven forbid we do that, Josh, with our poll question choices here, but we are curious about some great actor-director reunions and collaborations that are going to be happening again this summer, and we want to know which one you're most looking forward to.
All right, we've got five for you here. Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach for Francis Ha, Nathan Fillion and Joss Whedon doing something a little different this time, Much Ado About Nothing, Ryan Gosling and Nicholas Winding Refn following up Drive with Only God Forgives, and then one of my most anticipated films, Tony Leung and Wong Kar-wai making The Grandmaster, and lastly, Ron Perlman and Guillermo del Toro from Hellboy fame getting together for Pacific Rim.
And there certainly were other places we could go. We left out the Linklater, Delpy, Hawk, just because we thought it might just run away with the poll question. And I mentioned Iron Man 3. You could go to Shane Black from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang directing Robert Downey Jr. in that film.
Uh-huh,
he's now
yeah.
on board with Iron Man 3. So those are your choices. Josh, where are you voting?
I have to go with Tony Leung and Wong Kar-wai. It was my most anticipated film of the year, I think, when
I think it was mine as well, or maybe my number two. I'm with you. I really want to see that pairing again, though I'm curious about all five of them, to be honest, including Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach and Francis Ha, especially after Damsels in Distress and Gerwig's performance there. I'm really curious about this film, even if Noah Baumbach hasn't always worked for me. That's a collaboration going back to Greenberg that is a really good one. So we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. One quick note, and we could spend a lot of time going through some corrections. I don't want to get bogged down with that. The fact is, I did say, Josh, recently on the show during our tracking shots that John Wayne shot meeting the Ringo Kid happened in the first minute of the film. It actually happens like 15 minutes in. Sorry, haven't seen it since film school. It's been longer than I'd want to admit. But this one I did want to mention, especially as last week on the show, Josh, we inducted three new movies into the Pantheon.
Right.
And we shared our top five neo-noirs with Christopher Harris. And we got this feedback from Sam Embleman in Vancouver.
I enjoyed that you had a guest for the top five segment. It was nice to hear a newer voice in addition to the two of you. One thing, though, after Chris chose Memento as his number three, Adam said something like, well, there's a reason Memento is in the film Spotting Pantheon. Is it actually in the Pantheon? If not, it should definitely be considered at some point, along with a couple others, such as Donnie Darko and Fight Club. Memento was one of the first films I saw that made me realize that movies had the power to make you think long after the credits started rolling. Movies as art. Cool stuff for a 12-year-old. I'm sure you had the same experiences with other films as a kid.
So when I first got this email, I instantly went over to Letterboxd and our page there in the Film Spotting Pantheon, and I was all set to send him the link to say, yeah, of course Memento's in the Pantheon.
It's not there.
It's not in the Pantheon. And I guess I just assumed it was because it's come up so many times over the years. But even as we just inducted new films and I created that list on Letterboxd, you'd think that that list would have been more clear in my mind. I do have a little bit of an excuse, though. You remember a few weeks ago, Josh, when we put up the poll question, giving listeners the opportunity to vote on which movie should go into the Pantheon? At that same time, we asked listeners, which of these movies should be our next Sacred Cow discussion. Memento was one of the options in the Sacred Cow poll. Mixed them up. I think it should be there, though.
The only thing to do is we have to get the entire pantheon tattooed on our bodies so we don't forget.
Love it.
Et maintenant, mesdames et messieurs, l'attraction que vous attendez, le numéro le plus sensationnel du siècle, du spectacle, de l'émotion, de l'action, de l'histoire. Messieurs, dames, ladies and gentlemen, meine Damen und Herren, un fauve 100 fois plus meurtrier que ceux dans notre ménagerie, un monstre sanguinaire aux yeux d'ange.
That was Peter Ustinov as the circus ringmaster in 1955's Lola Montez, Max Ophüls's last film and the final one in our Ophüls marathon. Like the earrings of Madame De, this focuses on something of a notorious woman, although the notoriety of Lola, who's played here by Martine Carroll, spreads much further than Madame De's did. The character is partly based on the life of an Irish dancer named Eliza Gilbert. She eventually adopted the name Lola Montez and had a string of public affairs with prominent men across Europe in the mid-1800s. When the movie opens, Lola is using this personal history as the basis of a circus act in which she recreates her more famous romances for a judging audience. The clip we heard is of Ustinov introducing her as nothing less than the most sensational act of the century. Like all our marathons, which dedicate a number of weeks to a particular filmmaker, genre, or region, this one has allowed us to become familiar with recurring motifs and techniques. For Ophüls, we've spent a lot of time talking about his moving camera, his elaborately choreographed long takes. Lola Montez has some of that, but it also has something new. It's Ophüls' first film in color, and it probably shouldn't surprise us that he doesn't hold back, especially in the circus sequences. What did you make of all the colors at work here, Adam? Were they of a piece with Ophüls' overall style, or did you find yourself longing for that elegant black and white of his earlier pictures?
Well, I always kind of long for the elegance of black and white. It's fun to see. Especially when captured through the lens of Ophüls, but it was pretty wondrous here, I have to say. Not Technicolor, but Eastman color at the time is what it was referred to, and he definitely makes good use of it. You mentioned it during those circus sequences in particular. There's such a variety of colors, and there is a sense of warmth to a lot of those scenes and just really vibrant colors. But then we also get, as the mood of those scenes gets progressively more pessimistic, if that's the right word, or there's more suspense, and it becomes literally about life and death. We're not sure that Lola is going to survive this escapade in this latest performance. The colors shift as well, and we get some of those shifts to blues and some of the icier colors. So I really like the way he uses color here. But you talk about movement. We've talked about it this entire marathon for a reason. It really defines Ophüls. And what a week for movement after watching Malick's To the Wonder and Lola Montez. I saw these movies in the same day. And at this point, as much as I love the camera work in both, I'm ready for a good Romanian film where you just put the camera on a tripod and sits there for about 14 minutes.
All right, that's our next marathon, maybe. Out.
That's what I want. I need to just settle down a little bit. This was his last film, and watching it, you do get the sense that it was the culmination of his work in so many ways. Perfect place, obviously, for us to end the marathon as well. You've seen these meta elements, how often he has a storyteller in charge of dictating the story, sort of narrating events to the audience. We get that in La Ronde with the raconteur, Anton Walbrook, who also appears here. And we get it in Letter from an Unknown Woman, where it's Lisa who is the one dictating the flow of events. It's her letter that Stefan is reading and responding to. And here, he just takes it to that next level in the way only Ophüls could, where the audience storyteller connection is even more explicit. This story of Lola Montez is being presented as part of a circus. And you mentioned Peter Ustinov as our ringleader narrating her life. The curtain goes up at the beginning of this film, and Ustinov isn't talking directly to us. We can see the audience a little bit, and he doesn't really ever look right into the camera as far as I can recall, but he might as well be talking directly to us. This is a big show that Ophüls is putting on for us. We've also talked about the female characters in his films and how I would argue they're very strong female characters. They're certainly complex and interesting female characters, but there's nobody more headstrong in the films we've seen, nobody more in charge of her life, I would say, than Lola Montez. And I was maybe taking a cue from our guest last week, Christopher Harris. He read some quotes from Roger Ebert, and I read what Ebert had to say about Lola Montez, and I disagree with him here a little bit. He says the structure of the film is terribly artificial. He loves it, by the way. But he says the flashback suspended from a fantasy circus and the style itself is a highly mannered romanticism, but it works. Ophuls understands and justifies his method. He is not so successful, unfortunately, with the performance of the late Martine Carrell in the title role. Famous in the 1950s as a sort of prototype Bardot, Carrell was a third-rate actress, and she comes across as wooden, shallow, not even very attractive, Ebert says. I'm going to beg to differ. Not only do I think she's attractive, the fact is I think, like all Ophuls heroines, the camera adores her. He did this with Danielle Derrière in Earrings. He did it with Lisa, even to some extent, in Letter from an Unknown Woman. We see it with the women in Laurent. The camera just showcases them in a way where we are in awe of them, just like the characters in the film are. Sometimes women are in awe of them too, but often men. And I like the way, Josh, that she kind of walks into a room or sits down with men, and she isn't the one who has to instigate anything. She just sits there and lets them react to her. She's such a force of nature that she doesn't have to impose herself. And the men just start talking and reveal themselves too much. I actually think that's part of the performance. Maybe it's because she's not a first-rate actress, but I don't think that's a detriment to this film here at all.
She's attractive. I will disagree with Ebert on that one. But I
she's
think
stunning,
I don't know that she's very good in the film. Mm-hmm. I think she does serve the purpose Ophuls needs for the circus scenes, definitely, because she is ravishing. And that's what's being done in those scenes. She's being held up for the audience to be
adored. She's being put on display.
She's being put on display. So that works. I did find, especially in the flashbacks, which were a bit of a problem for me overall, just because they were so different from the circus scenes, I did find her to be too distant, too removed. Now, I understand part of the story is that Lola Montez has created this shell around her of protection, and that's why I think she is good in the circus scenes. But we don't get to see that crack at all. And I don't know that it's because she's putting up the shell in the other scenes or is unable to let us in the way that someone, say, like Danielle Derrière did in The Earrings of Madame Du. So I think that is missing here. But overall, I really went for this film as well. I would agree it does have the feeling of a culmination, as you said, though I believe Ophuls was already working on another film when he died, so I don't think he probably thought of it that way.
No.
But it has that feel in the sense that he's going for everything,
spectacle,
especially with the
grand
color.
Scale. Yeah.
I mean, the color is just outrageous here. It almost borders on garish. I mean, we have the deep reds, and the blue is probably the signature color. You're right, especially as it gets more sorrowful, it gets darker, more purplish. But there's also this green that's garish. It's almost a fluorescent green that one character in the circus has a wig, and I believe his eyebrows are even green. There's some really surreal touches to this movie that were jarring to me in a good way that I really appreciated. Those are all in the circus scenes. I almost wish I was in the circus audience and not in the audience for the film.
Huh.
Because I think these flashbacks are purposefully so, probably, but stodgy, traditional, conventional. There is other stuff going on there, but in comparison, it's such a shock to go to these other scenes that I do think suffer a little bit because Carrell can't quite carry them. But I do want to talk about Lola Montez as a female figure. Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of a different take from you in terms of her being in charge. In the flashbacks, you get that sense, but she's almost on this carousel that she started but doesn't quite know how to stop. And it's led her to this circus performance at the end where she's not very much in charge at all. Ustinov opens her act by saying, "We will begin with questions from the audience."
Right.
And they ask these outrageous things like, "Are you wearing a bra?"
Right. How many lovers have you had?
Exactly. And notice that she doesn't get to answer.
No.
Ustinov provides the answers.
Right.
So she's very much the puppet at that point. And I thought at first this is an interesting maybe parallel to an actress's life who is brought before an audience for their beauty, also for their notoriety in some cases, yet the audience isn't just appreciating that. They're sort of leering at her and then judging her for being leered at the same time. But then as the movie went on, it seemed to be more interested in fame in general and how people pursue fame. And I saw her not as a stand-in for famous actresses, but a stand-in for someone like Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton.
Sure.
I mean, that's the sort of historical figure she was. Now, she shacked up with kings, I believe, whereas, you know, we get, what, NBA players in our modern version are the contemporary kings. But it's the same thing in that this is a figure who is pursuing pleasure and wealth very publicly and has made a career, has made a life out of that. And that was pretty fascinating to see that play out in this older setting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the final film in our Max Ophüls marathon, Lola Montez. We're not disagreeing about how in charge or not in charge she is. I don't think she's the equivalent to Lisa in Letters from an Unknown Woman or to the raconteur in La Ronde. I think that Peter Ustinov is playing that role, being the one who is dictating the story to us. And yet, I think you can't overlook the fact, Josh, that at the end of the film, she's the one who's given a choice to make, and she does make that choice for herself. And throughout the film, she makes whatever choices she wants to make. And I wasn't prepared to discuss the relationship between Lola Montez and Kim Kardashian. Of course, I immediately recoil. I know where you're going in terms of fame and how we react. I want to give this figure we see on screen so much more credit than that. But I think there is something to say about the fact that two of the three films we saw were movies that ended in tragedy, that ended with depressing fates for our heroines. And that, spoiler alert, doesn't happen with this movie. And that's where I also wonder if it's almost a culmination for Ophüls, or it's him taking these heroines and taking them to another level and saying, okay, I've had so many characters who are defined largely by fate and coincidence and all these things conspiring against them. I'm going to now give you a female presence who does everything on her own terms. And the real tragedy for me at the end of this film is that the only logical place for a woman who doesn't allow herself to be a victim, a woman who, quote, acts like a man in society and does whatever she wants, the only logical place for her to end up is to be a circus freak. That's essentially right. What the movie says, that that woman exists so far outside of society's norms and is so unacceptable, frankly, that we have to put her on display for people to be fascinated by and repelled by. And that may be the clear connection to, I don't know about Kim Kardashian, but celebrities in our culture, or artists in our culture, is what I'd like to say. People who we're fascinated by but repelled by at the same time, maybe because of our own human frailties, and we see in them things that we wish we had and could do.
Yeah, not to belabor the Kardashian thing, but that's exactly it. The overall sensibility around her is to despise her, right?
Right.
But all she's really been doing is using whatever materials, connections, relationships she's got to pursue this life that is a lot like Lola Montez's. But I want to go back to what you were talking about in terms of the power she has, because it leads to a camera question I wanted to ask you. It seemed to me, in Ophüls' use of CinemaScope here, that the screen will frequently close in.
Yeah.
And I tried to keep track of that. I didn't notice it. I noticed it a couple of times, but didn't quite mark down when it was happening. So I may have missed some things. But by the time I was tracking it down, it seemed to be when Lola was closing in on a seduction, or at least closing a deal to her benefit.
Right.
So that speaks a little bit to the sense of power she had over her own destiny and her own life. I'm just wondering how you read those moments, or also these other ones that Ophüls used. And we haven't talked about this either. It's been throughout his films where the camera is tilted. It's at an odd angle one way or another. And that, again, is something that seemed to be emphasized here. I want to say particularly in the Ustinov scene where he's recruiting Lola to come work for him at the circus. So I'm just wondering what you made of those movements.
We do see those angles most often employed in the circus scenes. So it kind of links to those circus scenes. And I think it just adds to the sense of something off or spectacular about the circus that's different than everyday life, is the way I kind of read it. You're right about the curtain scenes. I think that those were largely, because that's what it is. It's almost like he shortens the frame.
Yeah.
He makes it less wide by putting in these black curtains on the sides to frame things a certain way.
That we can
way.
Actually see moving
and
in is what's interesting.
Exactly. And that occurred to me as a device to do just that, frame this story in a way, just as we're watching these flashbacks, because they are being told to us, they are being framed within the context of this circus. He's going to heighten that even more, make it more artful and artificial by showing it to us within a frame and differentiating again between the circus and the present day and these flashbacks in the past. So I actually kind of like that touch. The big thing for me is we talk about movement in the camera with this film. And I don't know, Josh, if you watched any of the special features on the DVD. I saw about 10 minutes on the Criterion Collection edition of this, where they did just kind of an overview of his career. And they have an interview with Marcel Ophüls, very fine filmmaker in his own right, known for being a documentary filmmaker, the son of Max Ophüls. And he talks about how obsessed he was with movement and how it didn't almost matter what the scene was calling for. He was going to find an excuse to move the camera. So he gave an example of one of the films we didn't watch, where a tailor needs a pair of scissors. And for Ophüls, it would never occur to him really to have the tailor just reach down and pick up a pair of scissors, or have someone next to him hand him a pair of scissors. Instead, the camera's going to have to follow someone as they go through the shop and find the scissors and bring them back up to him. That's just the way Ophüls approached these scenes. I don't think his interest in movement needs added justification, but throughout this marathon, it struck me as more than just an artful device, something that he wanted to do as a filmmaker. Go back to the scenes in Letter from an Unknown Woman where the jeweler that she goes to visit and he has like an apprentice, and there's that kind of comedic sequence where he says, bring me this and bring me this and bring me this. And
the spiral staircase.
Yeah, the spiral staircase, which he uses throughout his films. It has to be this winding, moving thing. Of course, it can't be just a boring old staircase. I think about that scene. I also think about the general in The Earrings of Madame Duh, and he repeats this here. He repeats a lot of tropes in his films that he clearly responds to or clearly are images in his head. In that film, the general leaves the opera to go find his wife's earrings, thinks they might be in another box or they might be in the hallway or they might be out in their carriage. And remember the whole comedic bit where he keeps walking through the door and there are two men seated right by the door. Their only job is to sit there and open the door for aristocrats.
Right.
And at one point, one of the guys finally says, if he does it again, I'm not standing up, basically, because it's so repetitive. That happens here in this film as well. There's a glorious sequence, Josh, and I love seeing it in color in this one, where the king, played by the brilliant Anton Walbrook, asks for some thread to sew up her top or her dress. And what happens? It starts a 3-minute sequence where every single person in his castle is employed in finding this thread. And we see these amazing shots of the camera going from the bottom floor all the way up to the third floor of this castle, following people around. And what I think it's doing, beyond just being elegant and kind of wondrous to see on screen, is it fits in with this larger theme of Ophuls about how the littlest action, the thing you do that seems trivial, can actually cause a tidal wave of things. And you do something that you think only affects you, maybe one other person. Turns out it affects hundreds of people in this house. And that fits in with this larger idea in his films that he's exploring about the confluence of fate and coincidence and free will and how much you can exert that on your own life. So that sequence for me was, again, kind of a culmination of some of these other sequences we've seen in his films, and it's really a joy to watch.
Yeah, it's certainly been the revelation of the marathon that the camera can be used so purposefully and thematically while it's moving. We're used to showy shots, and we get those all the time in really bad movies, especially mainstream movies. But when they're not given some sort of reason behind them beyond just the showiness, they do feel so empty. And
right. This
has such a richness when you do see these movies where they're used in a particularly different way.
That's Lola Montez. It is from 1955. It is the final film in our Max Ophuls marathon, though everyone tells us, Josh, including our esteemed producer, Sam Van Halgren, that we really do need to see Le Plaisir. And I would love to see it. I don't know if we're going to get to it here in the near future, but after seeing these four films, I certainly could go on a joyride through more Max Ophuls movies. If you want to go back and revisit this marathon, just go to filmspotting.net and click on marathons. You can find links there to all of our reviews. And we do have another marathon starting at some point. We can't really tell you exactly what it's going to be yet. Our direction we're leaning, Josh, we're pretty clearly leaning towards it as well, is Korean cinema.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
Contemporary Korean cinema. We're going to pick a few different auteurs there of Korean cinema and explore those movies. And that really ties in to Old Boy, the remake by Spike Lee coming out as he remakes Park Chan-wook's film. That doesn't come out till October. We might do that marathon in August, September. We'll have to see if we can squeeze in another marathon before we get to that one. Again, all of our marathon information is available at filmspotting.net.
Adam and I challenged ourselves to find 10 great scenes from Terrence Malick's 6 movies. Easy assignment or a chore? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
I'm waiting like a child. Hope runs wild. Truth can hide sometimes right behind the sorrow. I see beyond the smile, cheating lies. I'm not blind. Suicide still, I'll be here tomorrow. So leave it alone. Dogs come home. Even the storm finds a place within.
Hi, this is Martin McDonagh. You're listening to Film Spotting.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Scarborough here?
Yeah. The thing about him, he's down with the flu. He's sick.
Really?
Yeah. I'd invite you inside, except it's contagious. Don't want to start an epidemic.
No, of course not. It's only he called last night and asked if I'd come by.
Well, he didn't have it last night.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Martin Sheen as Kit with none other than Terrence Malick himself, appearing in an uncredited role in his debut film, Badlands. He's playing the caller at the rich man's house. Very eerie, bizarre sequence in that movie. But
he must have really not liked that performance because
he never did it
disappeared.
Again. Right. He showed up in that movie. Maybe an extra didn't make it that day or someone they had cast, and he decided to step in. But it's true. We never see him again act on screen. Seemed appropriate, though, to launch into our top five this week, Terrence Malick scenes, inspired by our discussion earlier in the show of his latest film, his sixth, To the Wonder. And I don't know, Josh, I guess if you're not a Terrence Malick fan, or if you're not someone at least interested in him and curious about his work, the show isn't giving you a whole lot.
Yeah, probably not.
It's been a lot of Terrence Malick talk, and we're going to continue that. Hopefully we will find a way to hold your interest. It's also probably going to be a little bit difficult because as we talk about scenes, and this being radio, you can't see why we love these scenes so much. And the visual aesthetic is so integral to what Terrence Malick does
sure.
and what makes these scenes in his film so special. I'm not sure the dialogue or some of the sounds we're going to include are really going to sell it, but we will try to do our best. And Josh, how did you form your list? What's your number five?
I'm going to have to start with something of a confession. I didn't go back and rewatch in their entirety any of his films for this, but I did dabble into a couple of them, and it wasn't as rich of a supply as I had thought when we first thought about doing this list. I think that speaks a little bit to my ambivalence with Malick. I adored some of his films. One, I mentioned The New World, have some problems with, and the others I appreciate. But I think it also speaks to the fact that, as we alluded to in our To the Wonder review, he does have this stock collection of images and techniques. So things are often repeated. And what I tried to do then is find the moments I remembered from his films that used those techniques and either perfected them or rose above them as familiar images and really used them for something purposeful. So one that stood out right away, though, this was an easy choice, is my number five, was when they make a home in the forest in Badlands. It is this moment of respite in the film where Holly and Kit have found a place to be together, to be childlike almost. It is a false sense of security they have, and we're aware of that throughout these scenes, which make them a little bit poignant. But I do really appreciate this sequence.
We hid out in the wilderness, down by a river in a grove of cottonwoods. It being the flood season, we built our house in the trees with tamarisk walls and willows laid side by side to make a floor. There wasn't a plant in the forest that didn't come in handy.
The fact that it's a fantasy they're trying to create, they're playing house, really, is what they're doing, it emphasizes their youth. And I think that's something that can get lost in any of these young criminals on the lam stories. We very quickly start to see them as movie characters or adults because of how they're behaving. But one thing we tend to forget is that they're often just kids. I mean, Sissy Spacek for sure is. And this sequence reminds us of that. There's also some wonderfully dreamy music here that stands apart, I think, from the heavy classical music that we now associate with Malick, at least. It's something that's much more playful called Gassenhauer. And it has this tinkling quality, which recalls a little bit the creek that runs by the area where they're at. So I do like that touch very much. Watching clips of this again, it made me think that there's almost something Wes Anderson-ish to this sequence and how they're creating this world. Maybe that's why I respond to it.
Maybe a little bit like Susie and Sam.
Making their treehouse.
Yeah, Moonrise Kingdom. I think that is an apt comparison, and that is a standout sequence from that film. Great pick. I think I approached this list pretty much the same way you did, Josh, with the help of some of our listeners via Twitter and Facebook and via email. I was able to put together for me kind of the greatest hits of Terrence Malick scenes, what are commonly thought of as his most famous sequences. And then there's sort of that just initial smell test of, yes, but do I really remember that? Do I remember it vividly without even having to go back and watch it? Just reading a couple phrases,
right.
Do I know exactly what that is? And does it connect me to the film as a whole and to his work as a whole? That's kind of where I started. And then what I did after I whittled it down to 8 to 10 of those, I did go back through all of his movies and didn't get to watch them in their entirety, certainly, but I was able to fast forward around and find these different scenes and see which ones had the biggest impact on me. And for my number five, I'm going with a scene from The Tree of Life that I'm going to call simply the dinner table fight. It's a sequence in the film, maybe about halfway through, where they're sitting down to a family meal, the O'Briens, the three boys, the father played by Brad Pitt, the wife, Jessica Chastain, and the father is just kind of haranguing the kids in this very disciplinarian kind of way. He is being a little bit obnoxious and really coming down on them, and you see the personalities of the kids so distinctly in the scene, and Malick doesn't overly draw your attention to it, but you can't help but notice the oldest son, who is our entree into this story, just sitting there next to him, kind of withdrawn, taking it all in, observing. The youngest boy across the table, instantly the rebellious one, sort of scowling at his father. And the third is outside the frame completely. We don't really ever see him, which makes sense because he's kind of separate from this flashback. He's kind of a non-entity in this flashback in this particular moment. The youngest son, he's getting kind of berated by his dad, and he just takes it in stride. But then when the dad turns his anger and frustration onto Jack, the oldest one.
Did you actually buy this from Mr. Ledbetter? Don't explain, just nod, yes or no.
Be quiet.
He tells his father to be quiet, and there's that pause.
What'd you say?
Where you know all hell is about to break loose. How does that kid have the temerity to stand up to his father and say that and not only just disobey him, but openly disrespect him? And you know that's not going to fly in this house. And I love that sequence so much because what you recognize there is that the father is fallible. The father isn't this heroic figure. And these kids are coming to terms with that. They're having this sort of epiphany at about this age where they realize that we can think and act for ourselves. We may be under his rule inside this home, but that doesn't mean we can't act independently and we have to accept all of this. And there are two touches that heighten it with the camera. The camera throughout Tree of Life is that graceful, seeking, searching, yearning camera. In this scene, when the father steps up from the table and gets ready to go at the younger son, the camera gets up with him and is actually shaky, which you don't see much from Malick, but it heightens the tension there in the sequence. And then I noticed something I'd never paid attention to before until I saw it again last night. The whole sequence starts with the oldest son, Jack, playing with his father's record player, the phonograph, playing the classical music that his father is sort of a failed musician. That's always what he wanted to do. He's warping the sound on the phonograph. And then they sit down and have this awkward, terrible family encounter at the meal. And as soon as the father steps up and the camera goes into that shaky mode, Jack actually hits the needle on the phonograph. He stops the music in that sequence. Really interesting touch there by Terrence Malick to break us out of that calm and the serenity that should be happening in this family meal. So that's one that when I saw The Tree of Life, there are many sequences that stand out in that film. We might just get to another one or two, but that one for me was always a big one.
So that helps me understand what you were looking for in To the Wonder as well, because this is a very different approach to a family argument scene.
Yep.
In To the Wonder, it's so oblique.
We just get the aftermath.
we only get the
physical confrontation part. Yeah.
Very different approaches there. All right, number four comes from To the Wonder. It's early on, with Olga Kurylenko as Marina running from the tide. We mentioned how the opening section of this film really catalogs Marina and Neil's romantic travels across France. One place they go is this unique tidal island of Mont Saint-Michel. The tide is out, so they're walking along the wet sand, and Marina is doing her usual twirling in the sand. The sand here is really fascinating. It has these dimples. I'm not quite sure what they're from, but as far as you can see, there are these dimples, and Malick's camera follows the incoming tide as it sort of rolls in and out of each one. For some reason, this terrain gives the water an extra vitality in these sequences. It's almost as if it's this living being that's pursuing
Marina. It's coming
towards
them,
It's coming towards them and really in pursuit. Now, in my reading, this could stand for Marina trying to stay ahead of the boredom and the familiarity that she fears is going to intrude upon her relationship with Neil. But otherwise, you could just get lost in the beauty.
You could. That's a great pick, and it's an image that certainly stood out to me in To the Wonder, where you almost wonder if Malick knew it and completely anticipated it and picked that scene for a reason, or was it a discovery there on set and on
location?
Did
they go there to capture that, or did they find it there? Yeah,
because he certainly has an eye. That's the thing about Malick, right, is you can watch so many sequences and you get the sense You get it in the Badlands sequence you talked about with the treehouse. You wonder if there are just moments that the camera captures that maybe were unplanned, but then they fit in to this larger scheme so well. That is a really good pick. My number four comes from the film I definitely think you need to go back and give another look at, and that is The New World. And there are a few different ones I considered, and certainly I went right away to the sequences that I remember vividly, which are the ones where John Smith is falling in love with Pocahontas, and he's been captured by them, and we see him in the water and in the forest and really just coming to appreciate their way of life and falling in love with her. But it's the sequence after that that really stands out to me, because he's been in this paradise. He's been learning their ways, their language, learning to appreciate their world. And of course, it being a Malick film, it's largely all told to us in voiceover. And he says that these people don't have words for lying, deceit, greed. They've never been heard. They don't have jealousy or a sense of possession. He could stay there forever with her. And if he could, he would. But of course, they're happy to unload him back on his own people. He gets expelled, if you will, from this Eden that he's been living in. That's a theme that's going to come up again and again. And when he goes back to his world, it's that return to Jamestown that is my focus. The way Terrence Malick captures the shock of what he returns to, coming from what he just was a part of, what he just experienced. The gate opens and it's a single tracking shot that follows behind him. And we see, without seeing his face, we get just from the way the camera is slowly following him and taking in the world as he's seeing it in front of him, we recognize that this settlement that he's returning to is not the settlement he left. It is not doing well. These are horrible living conditions. Things like lying and deceit and greed are clearly rampant. They're even worse. So are death, disease, and starvation. And then that sequence culminates with a showdown with David Thewlis, who has made himself the president of this community in his absence. And you just get this sense watching it that John Smith is mostly in shock the whole time at what he's been forced to return to. He didn't want to go. Now he can't fathom staying, and we don't blame him.
Yeah, I want to give The New World another shot, because especially as you talk about moments like that, I do remember some of the elegance that is brought to even moments of almost terror.
Yeah.
Like you're talking about there. I guess my thing, it's interesting because the way you responded to the wonder, especially in calling some of the scenes something like a J. Crew photo spread, that was my response to The New World. And I've seen other people say To the Wonder is almost self-parody. Malick has finally reached self-parody.
That
and that's exactly what I felt about The New World, is that this was a parody of what a Malick film could be.
That's so weird, because for me, The New World, coming off The Thin Red Line, was the film that put me back onto Malick.
Interesting.
It was the film that gave me hope that he was still, while in this abstract fantasy world, he was still tethered to the natural world and tethered to reality as well, and tethered to a good, compelling narrative. And it brought me back to Days of Heaven.
Maybe there's only so much Malick you can take, and maybe you just have to be purged of it at one point. I don't know. My number three comes from, the Tree of Life we'll talk about again. It's Dino Mercy. You could choose
Dino
the whole
Mercy.
Creation sequence.
My next band name.
Dino, you like that? Go ahead. You can use it. I didn't feel like that was fair to pick all of the creation sequence, even though you easily could. So I'm going to focus on this little bit. And it's coming somewhat towards the end, where a dinosaur is walking along a riverbed. I'm not sure what kind of dinosaur, so I'm not even going to try to misname it. And he comes across another dinosaur, injured, different type of dinosaur, laying there in the riverbed. All of a sudden, this mesmerizing mini-drama unfolds. The larger dinosaur, the one standing, stomps on the head of the one on the ground, holds there for a minute, then lifts its claw, puts the claw back down, lifts it again, and then, I love this touch, gives it one light little tap before going off and letting the other dinosaur live. And one of the deep theological questions that this movie explores is the origin of sin and the origin of mercy. So where do such things come from? Why are they both in us? This is the question that the older son is always asking himself. There's this new book out by Franz de Waal. It's called The Bonobo and the Atheist. And it's all about this question of the moral impulse, especially as it exists in animals. I haven't read it myself, but the parts I've looked at are really fascinating, especially in how they reflect what's going on in this scene between two dinosaurs. It's just this bizarre, perplexing touch in the middle of a very bizarre and perplexing movie that I love.
Yeah, I love it as well. It's an honorable mention for me. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five Terrence Malick scenes. If somehow you're not that familiar with Terrence Malick, he's the director of films such as The Tree of Life, Badlands, and Days of Heaven. And that's where I'm going to go for my number three pick. And It seems obvious, but it's obvious for a very good reason. And I'm going with the locust, the scene that happens near the end of Days of Heaven, the locust plague. It's almost like a horror film, the way Malick captures it. It's very subtle. It's got a very minor beginning where you see a locust appear on a head of lettuce, and then you see a locust in a wash basin. But then each frame, more appear. It makes me think of the birds a little bit in Hitchcock, mm-hmm, sure. Right? And how they appear. Until you get to the end of this entire sequence, the wheat fields are ablaze and it's chaos everywhere. But that beginning, seeing those locusts go from that small beginning into the plague that they become, mixed with the beautiful cinematography by Nestor Almendros, the editing, the music by Morricone, of all people, they all combine to heighten that mood and the sense of something unnatural taking place. Despite how natural it is, this is something that farmers can't experience. But when you talk about a plague of locusts, you're getting biblical. You're getting almost supernatural. And that makes me think of how it reflects on the story at that point in Days of Heaven, where you've got a couple who have been pretending to be brother and sister as a way to try to steal money from this farmer that they're working for. And this sham is coming to an end. And I think that locust plague not only helps exacerbate that, it makes it literally come to a showdown between the farmer, played by Sam Shepard, and Richard Gere's character, but it also metaphorically gives you this sense that this unnatural scheme is going to come to an end and there are going to have to be consequences for it. I will say about the fire, too, a little bit, that it takes me back to Badlands and a scene I did consider, which is where they kill the father. He's already killed Holly's father, put him in the house, and then tries to destroy the evidence or whatever, and he sets the house ablaze. And Malick in that scene, the way he shoots that house, he really lingers. We don't need to see that house. We could see the spark start and go on to the next scene, but he really lingers on showing that house go ablaze for many minutes. And I always kind of saw that as a metaphor for the entire film, Badlands, where something seemingly small, something that just seems to affect two or three people, becomes something that gets way out of control very fast. That's what we see with the fire. That's what we see with the characters in the film Badlands. And I think we see it as well reflected in the way this locust plague just gets completely out of hand in Days of Heaven.
That's my number two. Actually, I'm going to focus a little bit more on the fire part of that sequence in Days of Heaven. And the fact that it gets out of control. It almost seems like they've started it to burn the carcasses of the locusts.
Right.
And then it starts to get out of control just at the moment that Shepard comes after Gere and challenges him. And I love the line he uses there, "Let it burn." Previously, Shepard's farmer has been pretty much this gentle figure, you get the feeling. And here he just goes nuts. And I think for all the biblical allusions and imagery in Malick's work, this is really the only moment where he's gotten apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Even something like The Thin Red Line, the warfare there, it's constantly held in parallel with the natural beauty. Here, it's just apocalyptic as the fire burns. We go from the human faces of the workers to these ghoulish silhouettes. Suddenly, we're further back. We don't see their faces anymore. They're almost as if they're dancing in front of the fire is what it looks like. The tractor in the scene becomes this demon beast. So this really stands out among all the other moments in Malick's films for me.
I did find a bit of an interview with the cinematographer Nestor Almendros online, and he talked about how they achieved the effect of the locusts. He says that for our foreground, we use live locusts supplied to us by the Canadian Department of Agriculture. But for the wide panoramics, silhouetted tractors and blackened workers, we used a technique used in The Good Earth, running the camera in reverse and dropping peanut shells from helicopters.
Huh.
When the film was projected forward, the locusts would appear to be flying up. Of course, this meant everything had to act or perform in reverse, specifically the actors and the tractors.
That could explain some of the weirdness. Yeah,
how about
definitely.
That? Well, for my number two, I'm going back to The Tree of Life. Maybe not surprisingly, a film I love as much as I did, I'm going to find two really standout, memorable sequences from it. And this one I'm simply calling Innocence, because that's what the chapter is called on the DVD. We've just gotten through the beginning of the universe, creation of all life as we know it. And Malick then takes us to the creation of this universe, the main character's life, his birth. That's how the sequence starts. It's as breathtaking a montage, I think, you'll find anywhere. It's what really solidified The Tree of Life for me as the number one film of 2011. Some of those images that recur throughout it, the tiny foot, I think it's on the DVD cover, actually, that image of Brad Pitt as the father holding that tiny foot in his hand, the baptism, the boy crawling under the table after the ball, walking in the yard, learning to read. We get these great POV shots looking up at the mom, looking up at the dad, running through the house, running through the yard. And it all culminates with a shot of the new brother in the crib and him going over to that creature. You see where I'm heading with this, Josh? Beholding him, almost like that dinosaur we saw not too many minutes before, going over and having to take that in, this new life, and deciding how he's going to engage with that life. And that whole film is about that relationship with the brother, really, when it comes right down to it. So I think there's a clear juxtaposition there. But you get, in those sequences I described, in those images I described, the whole of young childhood in its entirety. Raising a kid, your first kid, there is an innocence. I think all parents out there will recognize this. There is an innocence and something unique, clearly, and special about that first child that you simply can't have with subsequent kids. And those moments are almost like you're in a paradise. They are their own kind of Eden. Everything is new. Everything is perfect as you discover the world together. And at this point, going back to my number five scene, these kids can't disobey their God, the father who created them. There's no reason to. Everything is just that perfect moment, the creation of life, and them existing in this beautiful world together, this harmony together in nature. In this case, it's their yard and their house.
It kind of makes you want to give up on recording any video of your children whatsoever after you've seen the
so
Tree
true.
Of Life, because you're just
the best
like,
home movie ever.
I'm not going to be able to even come close to this, so why bother? I'm going to stick with the Tree of Life for my number one. I could have honestly probably have done all five from the Tree of Life, so it had to be my number one, and it's the brothers with the BB gun. This is when the two older brothers head out on their bikes into the woods. And speaking of tracking shots, as we did recently, rewatching this, I had forgotten what a beautiful moving camera there is in this scene. It's following the older brother's bike as it glides into the tall grass. And you know, as you do to be cool at that age, you just hop off your bike while it's moving.
Right.
And the bike keeps going into the grass. And then without cutting, the camera catches the second brother following, doing the same thing. He jumps off his bike and it just follows them running along into the woods. Really lovely. So once they're there, they do some shooting at squirrels and fish. And then we get the moment in which the older brother, played by Hunter McCracken, dares the younger brother to put his finger over the end of the gun.
Put your finger over it. That. Come on.
After a terrible, terrible pause, sure enough, he shoots him. Malick doesn't linger on this action. He sort of glides away and then comes back to McCracken's face. How good is McCracken in
He's
this
so
movie?
Good.
I feel like when we talked about this film the year it came out, I know we mentioned him and mm-hmm. probably here and there, but we didn't go on like I did, particularly for someone like a child actor like Quvenzhané Wallace in Beasts of the Southern Wild last year. I think he's equally good in The Tree of Life, and he gets a voiceover shortly after this scene where he says, crucial line for the movie, what I want to do, I can't do. I do what I hate. Keep in mind that this scene follows these two brothers where they're also doing that lamp dare. The older brother has the unplugged lamp and he's daring the younger to stick a piece of wire in the mm-hmm. socket. So it parallels with that. What this moment did, and a lot of the movie did, is bring back those memories of childhood where you first start realizing that you're navigating moral waters and for some reason, inexplicably, you make the wrong decision. You do the
yeah.
wrong thing.
Wow. I had completely forgotten about that sequence, and I didn't come across it last night in my scanning, but you're right. It's a great one. My number one, we might as well end where we began with a little bit of overlap. I can't help but feature that treehouse hideout
nice.
In Badlands as my number one. It is that moment. They've only hurt her father at this point. And the fact is, you could argue, I'm being, of course, very general when I say this, he kind of deserved it. He doesn't seem like a good guy, right? He didn't deserve what he got. But at this point,
no, I see what you mean.
They haven't hurt any truly innocent people. They haven't gone on their killing spree. You're right. The music is so wonderful, not just the non-diegetic music, but the diegetic music in the form of Love is Strange. There's a point where they dance. This is their moment of freedom. This is them playing house, as you put it, out in this fantasy world. And, of course, I'll go back to this idea of it being Eden. And they're making use of their surroundings. She talks about in the voiceover the plants and the trees and the water, and we see the fish and how they're surviving on that. They're at one with nature, and at this point in the film, they're at one with each other, more or less. And that's one of the things I love is the matter-of-fact narration we get from Sissy Spacek as Holly.
We had our bad moments, like any couple. Kid accused me of only being along for the ride, while at times I wish he'd fall in the river and drown so I could watch.
Just so I could watch him drown. That's what she says, but just says it so matter-of-factly, like she's talking about her favorite Elvis Presley record. It's so great. A couple other things I noticed rewatching this scene last night. The sense of violence that we get throughout this film, you have to go back and consider this is 1971, the height of the Vietnam War. And throughout the movie, there aren't explicit connections that I recall made to Vietnam, but you do wonder if Malick is trying to say something about our association with violence and how you can start to see violence on TV and the bodies pile up and see it as abstract and see it as something that you can't really relate to, and you wonder if there is a connection he's trying to make there. This is that most explicit moment where when you see Martin Sheen, of all people, the guy who's going to be Willard in Apocalypse Now, running around with his shirt off with a gun, looking like he is trying to attack someone in the jungle, you can't help but there in that scene think of Vietnam. The thing I do really love about this sequence, though, Josh, the thing that makes it a truly special moment in this film, though, is just like in the Garden of Eden, this is Holly's bite the apple moment. This is when she finally becomes self-aware in this film and becomes aware of what they're about to embark on.
One day, while taking a look at some vistas in Dad's stereopticon, it hit me that I was just this little girl born in Texas whose father was a sign painter who had only just so many years to live. It sent a chill down my spine and I thought, where would I be this very moment if Kit had never met me or killed anybody? This very moment.
And she starts to see herself in the larger context of history. And she realizes that she's a part of this history, and she's also a part of the future, and that she's going to have a future that exists well beyond Kit, that this is just an episode for her and something she's doing right now, but she knows she's going to go on to something else.
For days afterwards, I lived in dread. Sometimes I wished I could fall asleep and be taken off to some magical land. This never happened.
And that's that moment of knowledge, when nothing can ever be the same between them again, and it never is.
Yeah, she's playing at innocence as much as she's playing at making a home or this new life. Mm-hmm. So sure, yeah, really is a fascinating scene.
Those are our top five Terrence Malick scenes. What about honorable mentions, Josh?
The one I considered a separate scene almost, the dancing at the end of the making a home in the forest sequence. I almost consider that separate. Where
the love is strange.
Yeah, I really like that little moment. Also, just a shot. This is almost just a shot from the Tree of Life. The kids' shadows while they're playing in the street. That one sticks with me. And you mentioned the house on fire in Badlands. That was an honorable mention as well.
Yeah, such a good moment. I had an honorable mention from Badlands as well. It's the ending of the film and the way the law enforcement people regard Kit and how Kit is just taking all of this in and gives them his comb. We talked about celebrity, Max Ophuls and Lola Montez. You think about how they are just fascinated by this character who exists outside their realm of rules and does whatever he wants to do, and they want every piece of him they can get. I love that sequence. I mentioned the falling in love montages in the New World. I also love just the beginning, the ships arriving, the natives in their natural environment, and then these boats, these invaders coming towards them. And as if we haven't talked about the Tree of Life enough, the he's gone sequence, the phone call that they get early in the film, these parents, now we've transported more to the present day, speaking of Vietnam, and they get a letter in the mail about their son.
Right.
And Jessica Chastain reads the letter, and then she calls Brad Pitt. He's at work, and he's at an airfield, and he can't really hear her. It's all communicated visually, really, because we can't hear what they're saying to each other, and she's reading a letter. And I'll be honest with you, I watched that again last night at about 2 in the morning, and it wrecked me.
Yeah, I believe it.
It wrecked me. It just destroyed me watching that scene again.
I remember watching the first time, and it's so oblique, again, to use that word, as a lot of To the Wonder is, that it took me a while to realize what they were communicating. But again, you knew at heart it was something terrible.
We can't wait to hear your picks for your favorite Terrence Malick scenes or any other comments about the show. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, Terrence Malick's latest film, To the Wonder. It is opening here in Chicago, but again, is also available via iTunes and cable on demand. There's also the latest movie from Rob Zombie, The Lords of Salem. It's about a coven, or as I like to say, a coven, of ancient witches who come back to haunt Salem, Massachusetts.
Are you a Rob Zombie apologist, Adam?
I have never seen a Rob Zombie film.
You haven't?
No.
You're not missing much.
Okay. Wow. Ouch. I expect to get a few emails about that. A few. Maybe not a lot, but we'll get a couple. Also out in limited release, It's a Disaster. This is a David Cross comedy that our buddy Scott Tobias called a droll comedy of exceedingly modest scale. And he says that Cross gives a masterclass in how to play the straight man. Also out, No Place on Earth. This is a doc about a cave exploration in the Ukraine and how it led to the unearthing of a story of World War II survivors who took shelter there. And finally, another documentary, Unmade in China, about an American director and his attempt to make China's first thriller. In wide release, Tom Cruise's latest movie. He's out to save mankind yet again, directed by the guy who brought us Tron Legacy. It's called Oblivion. Josh, our one movie to see, if there's one film in theaters right now, is To the Wonder, the one
you
recommend.
Yeah, I mean, that should be the priority, though. I got to say, Oblivion sounds intriguing. Tron Legacy, I mean, say what you will for the story, it had a unique visual style from Joseph Kosinski, I believe is the director's name. So that looks a little intriguing to me.
I have to go this week with a movie that I haven't seen. So I'm not really recommending it so much as just saying this is the film I'm most drawn to in theaters right now if I have a chance to go see it. It's one that opened, I believe, last weekend, and it's The Place Beyond the Pines from Derek Cianfrance, the director who made Blue Valentine, a movie I didn't really like, and I didn't really like Ryan Gosling in it, though he's an actor I can really appreciate. But there's something about this story and the little things I've heard about it so far that really draw me to it. It seems to be a very divisive film among critics, so that's something that always makes a film attractive as well. So that's The Place Beyond the Pines. That's the one I hope I can squeeze in here at some point. And if we do, we'll try to fit in a minute or two on the show. Next week, we're taking our own spring break. Michael Phillips and Tasha Robinson will be here. They are going to, we think, review the new Tom Cruise film, Oblivion, and they may share their top five post-apocalyptic movies, though that's something we've done fairly recently, but I'd love to get their takes on
it.
I'm sure listeners would as well. But stay tuned for that. The show topics are subject to change. We'll return in 2 weeks. It's our summer movie preview, so what else are we going to talk about on a summer movie preview show but Mud from Jeff Nichols and Upstream Color from Shane Carruth?
Hollywood tentpoles, right?
There you go.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Featured music this week was from Low. Learn more at chairkickers.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
From St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Sam. I'm Daddy Van Halgren. This is Film Spotting.
Daddy Van Halgren here for the conversation with my other guest, Daddy Van Halgren, my dad. Okay.
So, on today's show, we're going to talk about the Buster Keaton classic, Sherlock Jr. Now, as I recall, just a quick setup about the plot. Sherlock Jr., Buster Keaton plays a... he works in a movie theater. He's a movie theater projectionist. He wants to be a detective.
Yes, right.
He loves this girl, but he doesn't have any money. And it's silly. He falls asleep during a movie and actually dreams himself into a movie, imagines himself as the great detective, Sherlock Jr.
Yeah.
Now, what were some of the things you felt like you liked about the movie?
Because it was so crazy, because he was dreaming himself in the movie, and all these scenes were coming in. But one time, his head popped in the snow, and then it changed another setting. Every place he probably didn't see settings, a new thing appeared.
Was there anything that you didn't really like about the movie?
I just liked all the parts.
I did too. I thought it was amazing. I'd give it 5 stars.
I'll give it 500 stars.